Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Stuart N. Brotman and John Palfrey discuss Brotman's new book, The First Amendment Lives On, a collection of conversations with free speech scholars and advocates. The following conversation originally took place November 7th, 2022 at the American Writers Museum and was recorded live.
Hi, I'm Carrie Cranston, president here at the American Writers Museum. I want to thank everybody who is here in the room and thank everybody who is joining us online on Zoom right now. We're excited to have our program tonight, a discussion of the book, The First Amendment Lives On. And we are joined tonight by the author of that book and by John Palfrey. John is the president of John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, one of the nation's largest philanthropies, with offices in Chicago, New Delhi, and Nigeria. Palfrey is a well-respected educator, author, legal scholar, and innovator with expertise in how new media is challenging learning, education, and other institutions. He's the author or co-author of several books, including Safe Spaces, Brave Spaces, Diversity, and Free Expression in Education. We are very honored to have him here today talking to his good friend, Stuart Brotman, the author of The First Amendment Lives On. Stuart is an American government policymaker, tenured university professor, management consultant, lawyer, author, and editorial advisor and nonprofit organization executive. He has served in four presidential administrations on a bipartisan basis and has taught students from 42 countries in six separate disciplines: communications, journalism, business, law, international relations, and public policy. In an era when censorship and the discussions of the First Amendment are raging across this country, from book bannings to the question about who is in control at Twitter and what does that mean, we are very excited to have a conversation tonight about the First Amendment and what it's doing for us and how it's going to live on. So I'm going to give it over to John and Stuart. Thank you both for being here.
Carrie, thank you.
Well, it is a treat to be with all of you here in person in Chicago, and I understand that we have even more people on the live stream on Zoom. This is one of those silver linings from COVID, I guess, which is that we can have people from all over the world and also be here in person. And in particular, Stuart, thank you for coming to Chicago for this event.
It's great to be here, John. It's great to be here with you, great to be here at the museum.
Thank you. To Carrie, Christopher, the team, Allison, thank you for hosting us here in the museum. It's a beautiful space. And if you have not been recently, they have a fabulous new exhibit that you need to come and see. It's been up since September. What a great book that we have to talk about tonight, Stuart. This is so exciting. The story of the book, I think, is particularly interesting. So that's going to be my second question. But my first question is, what is your First Amendment story? Your bio is, it kind of defies getting into a few sentences, as you heard from Carrie. But I know one of the things you have asked those with whom you've been in conversation is how they got interested in the First Amendment. I'd be curious how that's so for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of the people in the book, in fact, everyone in the book, and certainly myself, and I think you and other people, have what I call a First Amendment journey. And my journey started out as a high school journalist. Like a lot of kids who were in high school, once upon a time, we actually put together newspapers and we laid type and we did all of the mechanical aspects of putting together a high school paper. But what was critical and still remains critical in high school journalism is, what do high school journalists cover? And it turns out that high school journalists, being budding journalists, want to cover things that are interesting and topical and sometimes very controversial. And often you have administrators and teachers and others who would prefer that those sorts of articles not appear in the high school newspaper. So I was very fortunate to have two wonderful advisors in high school for my high school newspaper who essentially said, "We will defend you in terms of what you want to publish." And obviously, I was in high school at a time of enormous social ferment in this country in terms of the anti-war movement, in terms of the feminist movement, a variety of other social aspects. And there were things that would not normally be in high school paper that high school journalists really wanted to cover. So my journey really started in high school and went from there. I went to school at Northwestern as an undergraduate. and worked in college radio. And college radio was another very fertile area for figuring out what you wanted to put on the air. And I grew up and worked in college radio at a time when alternative radio was just starting. And so there were controversial lyrics that were on the air for the first time, and there were call-in shows and people who wanted to talk about things. And so working in college radio as well as in high school journalism, I think, were really formative experiences.
That's fantastic, and it sounds like that same tie to journalism and publishing is in part what got you into this project. And I know we're joined here by Christy Hefner, and I know she and her family are essential to the story of putting this amazing book together. So maybe tell the story of the book, if you
like. Sure, and I would say Christy, essential, critical. The book would not be possible without Christy and the Hefner Foundation's cooperation. Basically, I found out through a third party that Hugh Hefner had compiled over the course of his life 3,000 scrapbooks, which began when he was a high school student at Steinmetz High School here in Chicago. I think he was about 16 years old. And he did this for 75 years until shortly before he passed away at the age of 91, 5 years ago. And every week, he essentially would block out time on Saturdays to scrapbook. Once upon a time, that was a verb. And people would literally collect things in their life. Today, we do that with a hard drive, or we do that online. But he would clip out different things that interested him and had them compiled in the scrapbook. And ultimately, 3,000 of those scrapbooks were put together over the course of 75 years. And the Guinness World Records says that's the largest collection of an individual that ever has done scrapbooking. Christy and the foundation granted me a unique and, at that time, unprecedented access to be able to review the scrapbooks. And I went to Christy and I said, I'd like to see what's in them, because there may be something interesting thematically that I'd like to maybe write about, maybe explore further. And lo and behold, what I found there was really the inner voice and the inner thoughts about the First Amendment that Hef had. Some of them were totally unrelated to his business enterprise, unrelated to Playboy. These were things that started, again, when he was on his First Amendment journey, when he was a 16-year-old at Steinmetz High School. And from that, I realized that there was not just his thoughts, but an entire legacy had been created by Christy, which was the Hugh M. Hefner First Amendment Awards. And these awards were created in 1979, and Christy basically was the person behind this. The idea was to really celebrate and honor people who would now be called profiles in courage, not necessarily famous people, although there are a number of very interesting celebrities and journalists and lawyers who have been honored, but the vast majority of the people that have been honored, and it's over 150, are people from all walks of life who essentially have had their own First Amendment journey and in many ways have impacted the journeys of a number of other people. I was at the First Amendment Awards this year, which was at the National Press Club. I brought the program here. I met a number of the people who won the awards. One of the people I just wanted to highlight, who was just an extraordinary teenager, an eighth grade student, was Jocelyn Diefenbeck. She's at Kutztown High School in Pennsylvania, and she was honored. And let me just read this very quickly. As an avid reader concerned about book banning, Jocelyn asked a local bookseller if she could start a book club where she and other local students could read the books that their schools had blacklisted. Firefly Bookstore quickly agreed, and the Kutztown Teen Banned Book Club was born. And they began to read books like George Orwell's Animal Farm and Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give and All American Boys. So a variety of books which now were banned by the school, but certainly she thought would be important for her peers and others to know about. So that's a great example. I could go on and on. We could talk literally all night about these 150 or so people. All of them have been extraordinary, and all of them have impacted their communities. In some ways, they've impacted our country. So Tom Devine, for example, is the head of the Government Accountability Project. And Tom really was the father or one of the architects behind the Whistleblower Act. And so today we have a whistleblower protection for federal employees. That wasn't the case until 1989. Certainly states still don't have that. But when you think about the importance that whistleblowers have for our democratic process, and also the fact that many of them are muzzled or fear that they're going to be disciplined or fired, now that we have a legal mechanism. So there's an example of someone who really made a difference. Frank Wilkinson is another person I've had the pleasure of learning about. So Frank led the drive to abolish the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was organized in the 1950s to investigate McCarthyism, and remained for many, many, many years until it was abolished. Elaine Williamson in Loudoun County, Virginia, she led a grassroots campaign that essentially reversed the policy of the public library to install internet filters. Mm-hmm. So when people went in and went on online, certain types of online content would not be available, would be filtered. And the First Amendment Awards have also honored some great organizations like the American Library Association and the American Civil Liberties Union. But what I found in addition to that was that there was this extraordinary group of people who I call the greatest generation now, of First Amendment scholars and thinkers and advocates, who I really wanted to sit down and talk to sort of get the arc of their thinking and journey about the First Amendment. And so I began to travel around the United States. I started here in Chicago at the University of Chicago Law School with Jeff Stone, the former dean and the former provost, and one of the preeminent First Amendment scholars, and then traveled to New York and Los Angeles and a variety of other places, and wound up with 8 very interesting conversations about the First Amendment.
Stuart, that's a wonderful journey, and I think leads in so many different directions we could go. Certainly want to pick up on banning of books and other current topics. I will pause for a moment on philanthropy and with Christy here to note how important that I think it is to use philanthropy to highlight heroes like the ones you've mentioned, some of whom we know well, you know, famous people like Jeff Stone who've done this, you know, for their careers, and also eighth graders who we may not have heard of. And I do think that's a fine form of philanthropy to help all of us to think through what the issues are. And it seems like it also led to your choosing these 8 individuals and having conversations with them and framing the book. Maybe just talk, for those who may not have read the entire book yet, just a tiny bit about the structure of the book, how you started with Jeffrey Stone's frame and built from there. But also, one of the things that I think is most interesting about it is we get a sense from the book of where the agreement lies, but also the disagreements that are very important. These 8 people do not think about the First Amendment the same way. And you draw that out, I think, really, really helpfully. They're all incredibly famous, part of your greatest generation of First Amendment thinkers, free speech and free press advocates, and yet they come out in different places on a couple of the key issues.
Absolutely. As I always say, there is no First Amendment orthodoxy. We might want to think about the Second Amendment. In the Second Amendment area, I think there is a general orthodoxy about the Second Amendment. First Amendment is quite different. There are people who have genuinely well thought out, well-articulated differences. And I think part of what the book illustrates is that, again, there is no one view of the First Amendment in terms of what must be followed. One thing I learned from the scrapbooks and really sort of spent a lot of time thinking about is how to organize these conversations. And I was greatly inspired by Heff's development of something called the Playboy interview, which is something many of you are familiar with, which I call literary art form, because up until then, and really since then, no one has really come up with a way to have these conversations. They're called interviews, but they're much different than a typical journalistic interview. They're really meant to have a person sort of open their head and their heart at the same time. And as I was walking through the museum this evening, I saw that Alex Haley is one of the people honored here. Alex Haley was the first person who conducted a Playboy interview in 1962 with Miles Davis. And since 1962, obviously, there has been a range of people. I have a little list here just to illustrate. And in some ways, the Playboy interviews, when you read them as a body of work, they really illustrate a marketplace of ideas. These were not people that Heff necessarily agreed with. In some cases, he may have disagreed with them greatly, but the idea of exposing their ideas to the public and to a wide readership. And so William F. Buckley was there, and George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, William Colby, who was the director of the CIA, and Jimmy Hoffa was there. Betty Friedan was there, Germaine Greer was there, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Anita Bryant, the anti-gay activist. And of course, Jimmy Carter was probably one of the more memorable Playboy interviews in 1976 when he was a presidential candidate, came up with that famous soundbite about having lust in his heart. So what I needed to do was sort of reverse engineer, how do you do a Playboy interview? And so what I did literally is to go back for each of these individuals that I was going to have a conversation with and read everything they had ever written.
Amazing.
I thought that would be a pretty easy task, but then I began to look at people's resumes. And when you look at someone like Jeff Stone or Nadine Strossen or David Cole, some of the people in the book, they just have enormous resumes, and not just that, but they have very, very deep and complex articles and books that they've written. So I spent a lot of time absorbing their thinking in this area. And then the notion that when we actually got a chance to talk, I did not walk in with any notes. And we basically did what we're doing tonight. We just had a conversation and I didn't have any particular thing I was trying to get out of them other than to get them to sort of give some exposure to how they think about things and how they feel about them.
And you get a little recording, I hope.
And they were recorded. I mean, one of the things we thought at the beginning was, do we come in with cameras and do they video? But we decided, just like the Playboy interviews, these were going to be much more intimate conversations. So literally, I went to either someone's house or someone's office, and we sat down and we talked for hours. And as you will see in the book, these are not scholarly conversations. I think they're intelligent conversations, but they were not meant to sort of be a lecture in print.
I'm really jealous of how you did it. Someday I want to do a book like that. It's really cool. Stuart, so spice it up. Tell us, what's the biggest disagreement in that book? Who disagrees with whom? What's the topic?
Well, sure. There are a number of them. Well, some of you may be familiar with Citizens United, which is a famous Supreme Court case of a few years ago, where essentially we now have unlimited money that could be spent in political campaigns. That was a challenge that went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld this notion of unlimited speech. The person who argued that case before the Supreme Court was Floyd Abrams. And Floyd Abrams is one of the great First Amendment advocates, and certainly was associated with the Pentagon Papers case, and opened up this whole world of commercial speech to thinking about the First Amendment. But Floyd thought this was very important as a case to take. And yet you have people like Jeff Stone, for example, who feel that this has really corrupted the political process and really has undermined democracy. And I think there are reasonable people, and both of these people are highly reasonable, who can have well thought out opinions on this, which can be very, very different. So I think this area of money and speech, particularly money and political speech and campaigns, remains a very vibrant and controversial area. And I think Floyd recognizes it. I think in the book he mentions that he's lost a number of friends because of it. And that's one area of disagreement. I think getting back to this area of campus speech. So Jeff Stone was tasked to oversee a report at the University of Chicago, which was a successor to a report that had been done by Harry Calvin, who was a eminent scholar that Jeff studied under with at Chicago. And the notion is, what principles should universities develop around freedom of speech? And so he came out with what is now called the Chicago Principles, and these have been adopted by about 70 or 75 universities, some public, some private, and essentially indicate that the university, in order to be a great bastion of thinking and free thought, really needs to be committed to very strong freedom of speech principles. That sounds very good. Then we have Nadine Strossen. So Nadine is the former president of the American Civil Liberties Union, eminent First Amendment scholar. And Nadine says in our conversation that she disagrees with that, not the idea that universities should be bastions of academic freedom and freedom of speech, but that universities also should be able to express themselves as universities. They should not be neutral. And she says universities do this all the time, because obviously there are certain principles of being at a university which have underlying thoughts and comments. And she believes that universities should be speakers as well as vessels for academic thought. So that's another area. A third area, obviously, is social media, which continues to evolve and be very controversial. And so there we have someone like Bert Newborn. Bert is the founder of the Brennan Center at the NYU Law School and was the former legal director for the ACLU. So Bert believes that some of the problems of free speech on social media are related to the concentration of power in social media. And obviously, we are living through that as we speak today with the acquisition of Twitter by Elon Musk. And so Bert believes there should be some greater attention to essentially breaking up some of these entities, or perhaps applying more stringent antitrust law, or thinking about competition in terms of how that's organized. Jeff Stone believes that it might be good to have something like what used to be in broadcasting called the Fairness Doctrine, which was in existence for many years, that essentially said that when there was a controversial issue of public importance that aired on a radio and television station, that essentially the licensee, the radio or television station, had an obligation to air contrasting viewpoints. And you might imagine that might be difficult to do in a social media environment. Jeff said, well, what if you haven't had a pop-up? When you see something online, maybe a little pop-up says there might be a little different viewpoint, and then you could click on it if you wanted to, but you wouldn't be required to do so. And then we have Bob Korn Revere is also in the book, who's an eminent litigator in this area. And Bob, I think, would characterize himself fairly as a libertarian in this area, in that he does not believe that any electronic medium, including the internet, should be regulated by the government. And clearly, we have a famous case that came out in the early 1980s, which you know very well, which is the ACLU versus Reno case. But the Supreme Court has actually spoken on the power and the uniqueness of the internet as a medium. And I think Bob would advocate, and I would probably agree with him as well, that there should not be any greater restrictions on the internet.
Wow. Well, I don't know how much time we have, but I would love to get back to all of those three topics, but I'm not sure we're going to make it, but we'll try. But I think if we can get to your campus speech topic, democracy, as well as Twitter, we should do it. So For those who are watching this on YouTube later, this is the day before the election in midterms here in November of 2022. So democracy is on the ballot. You put out book bans. I think on the ballot is also the ability to teach what people want to teach. So the CRT debate across the country, there are many debates, I think, that are kind of free speech debates a little bit behind the scene. Of course, the Supreme Court will be taking up a few specific speech cases. They're going to take up the affirmative, or are taking up the affirmative action cases, all which speak on it. What's on the ballot tomorrow or this year, Stuart, and how does this connect to the bigger questions of democracy?
Well, I think if we go back to Jeff Stone, Jeff really believes, and again, I may agree with him, that democracy is really on the ballot. And to the extent that we have a First Amendment, it's so intricately related to having a democratic process and a democratic system. And unless and until we have the sort of robust First Amendment protection, we're probably not going to have the democracy that we want. And so it's very important. There is so much happening, not just at the national level, but at the state and local level now, because clearly schools are controlled locally by and large, not nationally. And so we have school boards, we have library boards, and we have a number of underlying government organizations, and some are elected, some are appointed, that are now involved in this whole area. I think the last time I looked, there are about 140 bills right now throughout the United States that essentially are controlling specific aspects of what could be taught from K through 12. And so it's not just little kids, it's really the entire primary and secondary education system. And so all of these things are to some extent on the ballot, even though many people are not aware how intricate and how complex the relationship is between banning books or restricting content and going to the ballot box itself.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. I think it's such a crucial moment on all these fronts. And if there were another whole podcast and discussion, I'd love to get into your thoughts on whether these 140 plus bills will be able to stand. It seems to me so many of them are so content specific, and at least procedurally, you'd think there might be some concerns. But in any event, you mentioned local. I did want to ground us here in the great city of Chicago. One of the really exciting things that's going on, and Christy and others have been involved in this, is I think a real renaissance in the news space that particularly as there have been many changes in the business model on the for-profit side, there are both for-profit and lots of nonprofit organizations in lots of communities, very diverse around the city, that are popping up and growing really effectively as a way of covering the city, and in a way I think that's honestly more genuine and more effective than the past. And I wonder if you could tie in some of these kind of local press issues to this book, which of course does touch on some of that as well.
Sure. Well, one of the people I had a wonderful conversation with was Lucy Dalglish. And Lucy currently is the dean of the Barrow College of Journalism at the University of Maryland, but spent many years at the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, where she was the executive director. And so we really talked about the future of journalism, and in particular because she's responsible for training future journalists right now. I'd say the good news is we are to some extent in a early renaissance of journalism. I think there is great interest now, particularly in people studying journalism. As you say, there is now almost an organic process of local media and certainly philanthropy supporting it, the MacArthur Foundation and others who are doing it. So I'm reasonably optimistic in terms of that. I'd say if there was going to be a pretty encouraging theme here, it might be in the free press area. So I think last week or the week before, the Attorney General Merrick Garland actually issued a memorandum which essentially said that the Justice Department from this day forward will not ask for the confidential sources of journalists. And that is a big deal, at least at the federal level. Clearly, we don't have shield laws, which means that this can be done at the state level or the local level. But to have the Attorney General of the United States now say we essentially are drawing a red line and no longer will subpoena journalists for their confidential sources and bring them before grand juries. And if they obviously don't testify, we can put them in jail. We had a series of these incidents really in recent history. And so I think that's a really encouraging development that's happened in the area. And also we've seen recently a number of major libel suits in this area, where I think the media has withstood the potential for being undermined by our laws of libel and defamation. And so I'm pretty optimistic in terms of where things are. Obviously, so much of it depends on the business model. Right. And I think that's another conversation for another time. But I think to the extent so far that not-for-profit, I know the Chicago Sun-Times here is an example, and other foundations and other ways of thinking about journalism. And again, going back to the First Amendment journey, there is an enormous amount of good journalism and exciting things that are happening on college campuses with student media. And again, they're not just newspapers anymore. There are college television stations and news broadcasts and podcasts. So we're really in a good space, I think, there.
It's so interesting to think about it from the perspective of the right to a free press and the sort of policy side of that, where there's a decent story. I think on the, as you say, the business model side, it's a much more challenging picture. And when you think about, at least in the United States right now, that there's about a third of Americans in rural areas in particular do not have a daily or a meaningful kind of local media coverage that they had, you know, a generation ago and so forth. So it has gotten much trickier. And I think that ties into those democratic conversations at the same time. So the legal protections seem like they're maybe more robust. But let's, since you brought us over to the campus. So one of the things that I wanted to press you on a little bit, which I think is one of the more troubling kind of stories here, but behind the scenes, I've gotten very interested in the data around who supports the First Amendment and in what ways. And if you have followed the series of studies that the Knight Foundation has funded, what's clear is that actually young people do support the First Amendment. Strange that the media often say, you know, kids don't believe it. It's actually not true. The support for free expression, particularly among young people, has actually gone up, not down over time. So this is not a generation that hates free speech. That's not true. But there are very challenging issues within the data in terms of who supports it. So if you're asking a white young person, they're much more likely to support the First Amendment and to believe that it protects them than if you ask a young person of color. And so we've got a complicated story. And if you think about who works on First Amendment, my observation is that many of those of us who have devoted ourselves to it are white, that there are actually not that many people of color who've been working on the topic and so forth. It is, to my mind, a challenging circumstance. I wonder if that came up in your discussion, because of course these are for and should support all of us, but that's not really how it's perceived or maybe playing out in practice.
Absolutely, and I think the Knight Foundation and then the Freedom Forum, there have been several major organizations which have done tremendous work in terms of being barometers, saying, you know, how do people feel about this now? So it goes both ways. What we see, as you say, is that generationally, we still have younger people who believe in the First Amendment. We have older people who believe in the First Amendment. What's interesting is it's now breaking down by race, by gender. And I'll give you a couple of quick statistics here. So in terms of men and women, men are more favorable towards greater First Amendment protection than women. At least this is what the data shows. We would not have thought that maybe 10 or 15 years ago, but now we have data that we can deal with. I just spoke a little bit about how encouraged I am, or reasonably encouraged I am, about journalism, but the data is not as encouraging. So, for example, in the latest survey of the Freedom Forum, on the First Amendment, they found that the majority of Americans, again, in the survey, want journalists to be licensed. And that obviously is antithetical to everything we think about in terms of freedom of speech. A near majority, 46% of the people who were surveyed, want to have content related to sexual expression or sexual identity in books restricted. Again, antithetical to the First Amendment. So I think the data, when you look at it, can be quite troubling. And I think it's also a way for us to begin to think, how do we move that needle in a more positive direction? How do we get some of those views changed?
When I was the head of school, and to some extent as a law professor, one thing I observed in the discourse when this topic would come up was that either, often, I'm oversimplifying, but this happened too often, either you were for the First Amendment, and often were perceived actually to be on the right in the conversation, or you were for diversity, and you were perceived to be on the left. Do you see that dichotomy? Did this play out, and do you see any way of resolving that? Because my sense is that's not a particularly healthy way to see the topic.
It isn't. And again, this is well beyond what I call the jurisprudence of the First Amendment, cases and precedents and everything else. And we need to think a lot harder and deeper and, I guess, more systematically about how we create a First Amendment culture mm-hmm. in our society. And it's a culture, obviously, that would span racial, gender, ethnic divides. And I don't think we've really done as good a job as we can in that. And again, I think everyone does have a First Amendment journey, but we need to begin a larger national conversation about the First Amendment. I think when the First Amendment awards were organized by Christie in 1979, one of the things that was done was that the Zenger papers, John Peter Zenger was obviously a famous publisher in the pre-revolutionary time, who was prosecuted by the British for libel and was acquitted and became a champion of what we now know as freedom of the press. But those papers toured around the country, and also high school students began to write essays, what the First Amendment means to me. What if we sort of did the same today, but we did it on TikTok? Yeah. What if we had loads of TikTok videos out there with people talking about the First Amendment? I just wanted to spend a couple of minutes because I know we've spoken about this and I've written about it. This notion of maybe before the baseball game or the basketball game or the football game, maybe when we rise to do the Star Spangled Banner, the announcer says, "And now let's recite the First Amendment, and then we sing the Star Spangled Banner." And of course, we have Jumbotrons, so it's pretty easy to read those 45 words. But imagine if every game we went to had that. And of course, all of these games are televised. And so we, just like we learned the Star Spangled Banner, we would be able to do that. The same for movie theaters. Every time we go to a movie theater, when you have the previews and the commercials coming on.
And the copyright notice.
Right? And the copyright notice, right? Right. Don't video. What if you had someone in that movie come on and say, "This movie is here partially because the government doesn't restrict it." And this again ties back into what I saw in the scrapbooks and Hef, but Hef had a particular passion for movies and movie censorship, meaning not having movie censorship. And the other person in the book who is really different than the people we've spoken about is Professor Rick Jewell at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. And Rick is one of the great scholars of film censorship. And many people don't remember or realize that we have a long history in the United States of movie censorship. And it was only until the 1960s that we had censorship boards that looked at movies in cities. The last one was in Dallas. It was abolished in the 1960s. But once upon a time, if you wanted to show a movie here in Chicago or in New York or in Dallas and certainly in Boston, everyone knows Banned in Boston, that had to be viewed by a government board, which essentially said, "We will decide whether or not people should be able to see that." So we've come a long way, which I think is good. But what's interesting in the conversation with Rick is to retell and relearn the history of movie censorship, which is very important. And the other really interesting aspect of the book with Rick was that Hef taught with Rick movie censorship at USC for 20 years. And I don't think anyone knew this. And it was certainly not part of his public persona, but it was something that he really loved and was really dear to him. And he showed up every year and basically ended each of the semester's classes on movie censorship with a completely open discussion about movie censorship, about obviously some of the issues he was dealing with in the First Amendment. And he ultimately was called the third professor because his two colleagues there obviously were teaching the course, but without having him sort of bounce those ideas, the course would not have had that texture.
So Stuart, last question for me, then we'll open it up, which is to bring it home with Elon Musk, Twitter. One of the things that's happened since he took over in the last few days that I've heard reported, and I have not verified this myself, although I've been on the platform, is a huge rise in hate speech, very, very quickly. Increased use of the N-word, for instance, in the last 24 hours, 48 hours. What's your reaction to this big change in our social media world?
Well, it's a mixed reaction. I mean, one thing I always do is I go back to the data. And although Twitter is an important part of our cultural conversation today, it's not as important as we think it is. Mm-hmm. And so only about 15 million people in the United States are really active Twitter users.
How many Twitter users here by hand?
Okay.
And, about a third, maybe.
Yeah. So out of a population of 330 million people, 15 million people essentially are intensely involved with Twitter. So the question is, how much should we worry about those 15 million? Are they essentially the people who will wind up influencing those other people? So, and Twitter is not even the most popular social media outlet. So today we have TikTok, for example, which is a much larger outlet, and YouTube. And so one of the questions also is, what do we do not just about text-based messages, but we're talking about the world of video messages, and ultimately we're going to be in the world of the metaverse, where we're going to have three-dimensional experiences. So we are literally just at the beginning of this journey that we're all taking collectively with respect to the First Amendment. And I think that's part of why I call this the First Amendment Lives On, because it's organic. We're living it. We are, in some cases, we're not quite sure what's going to happen. And I think that's part of the experience, but we also have the ability to shape it and certainly to look back and rely on some of these tremendous thinkers and advocates in this area. And I'm glad I was able to capture them.
And with that, I think this has been a wonderful conversation. And we wanted to thank both of you for being here tonight and talking us through this very deep and important topic. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, tune in to the Ukrainian and Dissident Writers Tour, presented by the Continental Literary Magazine. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.